Happy New Year. I hope your 2020 is starting off with a bang. Thank you for listening to Author Stories through 2019 and all of the previous years. We had an amazing year last year and looking forward to doing bigger and better things this year. Before we get into the interview, we're going to thank a couple of sponsors who make the show possible. Please give them a shout out and look them up on Amazon and make sure that you tell them that you appreciate their sponsorship of Author Stories. At the end of the show, we're going to have an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War. This audio clip is narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. You're going to love this series. I love it so much. And Richard has been a great supporter and sponsor of the show, and we're going to show him some love. Listen to the audiobook excerpt. You're going to love it, and be sure to go to audible.com to purchase it. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you can get a free book just by signing up for a free trial at audibletrial.com/Hank. You get a 30-day free trial. You get the free book. If you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, you get to keep the free book, and it doesn't cost you a single penny. audibletrial.com/Hank, and listen after the show for the clip from Richard Fox.
We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC, without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today. Visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Julie does not love being the center of attention. She makes dresses for those who do. But when Emily, her matchmaking friend, begs for a favor, Julie can't say no. It was supposed to be just one date. She never expected to kiss the guy, then fall head over heels for him. When threats start rolling in, it becomes clear someone will do whatever it takes to break them apart. Now she's in too deep, and walking away isn't an option. But with the paparazzi and drama involved, Julie cannot help but wonder, who wants to love a billionaire? Hollywood producer Harry Jackson is not an alpha male. He's goofy, sensitive, and will move mountains to make everyone happy. In fact, he requires a whole team of people to keep him from being robbed blind. Sometimes he even needs saving from his love of bad puns. But when an enemy threatens to jeopardize his chance at love, it's time to step up and fight. He's terrified, but the thought of losing Julie scares him more. Pick up Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? The Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Peter Riva on the show with me. He has a fantastic new book. It's called Kidnapped on Safari. It's the third book in the Mabuno and Perot book series. What a fantastic read. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Oh, thank you, Hank. Thanks for inviting me. That's very kind.
I'm excited to have you. Like I told you before we started recording, I love this book. It's such a thrill ride and such a unique book in this space. And we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think it was probably when I was a kid. My brother and I used to make a lot of model airplanes and boats and things like that. And whenever I was finished making an airplane, I would make up a story of who was built for and where he flew in the war and so on. I was born in 1950, so I'm what a young friend of mine calls a wrinkly. And and so a lot of my memories as a child are based on leftover memories of the Second World War that my parents and my grandmother had. And sure. We were sort of obsessed with those stories at the time. So I used to make up my own little stories about that. And then, of course, I also grew up in the time and age of the cowboys and Indians, and always used to make up stories about finding the villain and who was robbing the stagecoach and capturing him and turning him over to the authorities, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I used to write stories when I was a kid just for the fun of it. The strange thing is I grew up in a family that was part of the performing arts. My mother was a television actress and my grandmother was a movie star and also served our country well in the Second World War. And, you know, when you're around people of that kind of creativity, some of it rubs off. Not very much, unfortunately, but enough maybe to make me write a little bit.
Well, when you come from stock like you do, that is artistic, creative, and prolific, is finding your own artistic voice, is that something that's encouraged, that's cultivated, or is it just kind of by osmosis? You just pick it up just from being around people like that?
A combination thereof. I think that when you grow up in a creative family, the ethic of the family is that anything is possible. You can achieve that which you want to do. So in life, I've taken on very large projects. I co-negotiated the first global environmental treaty between the USA and the USSR. I was the project manager for the Voyager Around the World flight. I found 185,000 handheld images taken in space by the astronauts that nobody had looked at before. I've produced 78 hours of primetime television. You know, the answer is you just keep working and find something that interests you. The one thing that is, I have to say, I got from my family is that don't do anything that you're not interested in. And you know, in the true sense, I'm a dilettante, which is kind of rude in a way. But, you know, it means I do those things that I can be passionate about. Otherwise, I don't do them well. And my books are based on my own experiences in the bush, my own experiences in Europe, and soon there'll be another one. It's kind of fun to pass on the stories and the places that I've been. I liken it to that. I hope people read my book and have a mini safari in Africa. That's kind of my goal. I want them to feel that they were there because I write about the places I know in Africa as characters in the book, and they have their own reason for being there and their own entity.
Well, and that's how it reads. You know, when you describe a place and it completely encompasses everything about that place, from the way it feels to the way it smells to the way the weight of the local culture sits kind of on your shoulders, you know, that it does become a character, and you become as comfortable with that place as you do the people that you kind of form this weird relationship with when you read a book. It's fascinating when done well. It's like you can stand back and not quite understand exactly how it happened, but you're just glad that it did.
Yeah. You know, the center character in the book, obviously Pero, is based very loosely on some of my own experiences as a producer in the field. So he reacts as a producer does. Of course, he has other talents and contacts that I never would have. But the Nimbuno is really, for me, the central character here, because in real life, the man Nimbuno, he was a guide for people like Bill Holden and Gregory Peck and Hemingway and so on. And his father was a guide for Teddy Roosevelt. And he, long tradition of being a safari guide. And Nimbuno had this connection to nature that really helped me understand that all of us are part of nature, whether we want to be or not. And there is no concept that as a human, I'm better than the animals around me. I am part of that same scene. It doesn't, and by the way, I'm not sort of promoting vegetarianism or anything else here. It's that, you know, we're part of nature, and unless you feel that connectedness, unless you understand that you're not superior to nature, you really can't go through life enjoying the bounty that nature provides. I live in Gila, New Mexico. The bottom of my small property here is the Gila Wilderness, which is 3.5 million acres of wilderness. And the bears, the mountain lions, the snakes, the javelinas, the coyotes, the foxes, the wolves, they're all part of the existence I have here, and I love every moment of it. This morning I woke up and there was a flock of 20 wild turkeys looking at me through the windows, wondering why the hell I'm here.
Peter, reading through your bio and trying to follow the path of your life is fascinating and kind of reads like a novel in and of itself. As someone who began your college life as a pure math major, and then you transitioned to film school, then working with people in the aerospace and space exploration, world, and then winding up in Africa, you described yourself as a dilettante, and I kind of see that, you know, and with passions that tend to burn white hot and will take you anywhere. What was it that took you to aerospace and space exploration first?
Well, at the time I was working with a French photographer by the name of Lucien Clergue, and he was friends with a great American photographer, Ansel Adams. And I was out in Carmel and spent a couple of days with Ansel and his wife. And, I didn't really understand photography, so I asked Ansel to explain it to me. One of the things that you have to learn when you're around a lot of creative people is to ask questions, and they don't mind being generous and helping you. Since I didn't want to pretend I knew what photography really was all about, so I asked him, and he explained form and emotion to me, and that the human spirit that comes through the image is what creates the art form. And I said to him, well, you know, the weird thing is, just a week ago, I was looking at images from space, and I'm fascinated by the technical side of it and the fact that we went to the moon and everything that's going on in space, but the images themselves are pretty boring. And he said, you know, that doesn't make sense, because when you listen to the astronauts, they're full of passion. So he and I made a couple of phone calls, and then I went down to NASA and found out that the NASA only ever took cameras into space as measuring tools. They never took them for any other purpose. And so they would give a shooting script to the astronauts for a roll of film. Once they took the 5 or 6 images that film was designated for, the astronauts finished the roll of film on what they wanted to film. But when it came back to Earth, since it wasn't on the shooting script, it was just put in the freezer vault.
Oh, wow.
So we found 185,000 images there. So that got me involved with the astronauts, and they're wonderful people, and we did an exhibit. I got Senator Kennedy involved to get NASA to give me access to all the footage, and we did an exhibit which opened at the Air and Space Museum and is still touring worldwide. And because of that, pilots and astronauts talk, and then these pilots, these two people out in the West Coast, they had this project. They wanted to fly around the world nonstop, non-refueled, which had never, ever, ever been done, period. I went and saw them, and it was an opportunity to do something that's really historic. You know, I think I've lived my life with the concept of try and be at the vanguard of something at least 3 times in your life. Because if you're not at the vanguard of something, you're not advancing humanity. You're not contributing to the people around you. Some soldiers do that every day that they're in service. I wasn't in that kind of service, so I chose to undertake projects sometimes that did a little bit for my country and a little bit for mankind. And I went out there and stayed on, and I was basically the floor sweeper, the marriage guidance officer, the fundraiser, the you name it, I did it. And they flew around the world nonstop, non-refueled in 86. And just for the record, nobody else has ever done it since. There are people who have done the distance, but if they did geography and geometry, they'd know that if you don't cross the equator, you're not going around the planet. And the only people who have done that is Dick and Gina.
Wow. What a fascinating thing to just get to be a part of. That's so amazing.
Well, it was kind of funny. The guys from DARPA showed up one day and said, we'd like to see the plane. And we went, the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration, sure, it's there in the hangar. Put $5 in the jar and you can go see it. No, you don't understand. We actually want to see the plane. And I said, yeah, there's a jar there. You put $5 in it and go into the hangar and look at the plane. And they said, you mean the public gets to see the plane? Well, in the end, Dick gave them some of the plans of building the Voyager, and we learned a year and a half later that Boeing got a $200 million contract to build a replica as a spy plane. And I said to the guys, I saw them at the Paris Air Show, and I said, you know, guys, you could have given us 1% of that, and it would have funded our entire project.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Well, we mentioned earlier that how the place of Africa becomes a character in this book, and you obviously have spent quite a bit of time there and soaked up the local culture and the sites. What took you to Africa, and what made you fall in love with this place?
Well, I first went to Africa when I was 16, mostly Northern Africa, and then in early 80s, a client of mine, Peter Beard, who's a photographer, got himself in some hot water in Africa. They were trying to land grab his property, and there was some threats against him. So I went there and sorted that out. And I kept going back again and again, and I met this fellow, Mbuno. And I would, for instance, Mbuno and I walked across the Maasai Plain, which is eight miles to the Ngong Hills. And then we'd walk back again. And when other people who were in Africa had African experience, they'd say to me, what do you mean you walked across the Maasai Plain? That's dangerous. You shouldn't do that. And, you know, I said, are you kidding? The lions watched us walk by. The hyenas were fine, had no problem with the rhinos. You know, I wasn't threatening anybody, and they knew that. And I was walking, and they weren't threatening me. So, well, did you have a gun with you? No, you just go walking. And people don't understand that if you're with somebody who understands nature, as Mbuno did, your presence and the way you present yourself in the wild pretty much assures your safety. You don't need, you know, to be fearful all the time. Cautious? Yes. Fearful? No.
Wow. So you, for the last 30 years, you have spent as a literary agent. What brought you back to that? Such diverse interest and such a diverse palette that you painted with your life. What brings you back to book publishing?
Well, Hank, I don't mean to sort of correct you, but it's more than 30 years. Sadly, I'm getting old. the truth is, when I left UCLA film school, I went back to England where my girlfriend was, still my wife. And there was a program at the BBC called an apprentice program, and I joined that, and they made me a gopher on the lowest rated television show in Britain, which was Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Wow.
And I literally was the gopher, nothing more. They had a scene where they had nuns who had to dress up it was called the tennis penguin sketch. And these nuns had to dress up and be prepared to bare their breasts. And so I had to go hire the hookers who were willing to. Anyway, that's kind of the level of job I had. Summer hiatus came, and the guys were hanging around and saying, well, what are they going to do in summer? And one of them said, geez, we'd really like to do a book. And my father was doing licensing at the time, toy licensing, and so I went and talked to him, how do you do licensing? And he taught me how to do it, and I went back and advised them. And it kind of got me involved in licensing, and I started that in 72 and 73 and kept going. Books were a natural extension from doing licensing generally. I did a lot of work with the Hollywood studios on Star Trek and things like that in Europe. And then in 81, we moved to New York and I became a full-time literary agent. You know, helping authors who have wonderful ideas and things you can learn from. And I'm a information junkie, so I love reading and I listen. I have to admit, I'm a radio junkie. I listen to the radio all night while I sleep. I have an earpiece. I sleep with it on in and I used to have a shortwave radio, and I listened to voices around the world on shortwave, and I kind of miss the crackle and the fading voices. But nowadays with the internet, you can just change channel when you wake up in the night. And I you know, for me, getting authors published who had great stories to tell and are wonderful people was a joy, and it still continues to be a joy. I'm still doing it. There was an author, you may like this story if you have time for it. There was an author by the name of Stieg Larsson, and he passed away. He's a very famous journalist, investigative journalist in Scandinavia, mainly in Sweden. And he lived in the same building as an editor I worked with called Per Faustino at Norstedts, and I was their agent here in America. And Per Faustino tells a story which is absolutely classic. Per says that one day he got into the elevator and Stieg Larsson comes in and says, you know, you're an editor. Would you read the manuscript I've written? And Per Faustino says to him, you had time to write a manuscript? Everybody knows you're a workaholic. He says, yeah, 2 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep, I type. So he said, sure, I'll read it. So Stieg gave him this plastic bag the next day with 1,500 tightly spaced pages of one manuscript. Now, unpublishable instantly. It's 3 times bigger than any book you could think of. So Per Faustino took it back to his office and said, okay, I'll humor the guy. I'll read the first 20 pages. Well, of course, he got hooked. The problem was it was unpublishable, so he talked him into splitting it into 3, and the first book became The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I mean, that kind of happenstance is such fun when you're part of it, when you see the success of something and how, you know, every single part of those books that Stieg Larsson wrote, all those facts in that book, like John le Carré's book, exactly the same, all the facts are true. They may not be actually factual at times because you have to change time and place and the name, but they're all true. And one of the things I do in my book is everything you read in my book is true. It may not be factual because it didn't happen at that day or the names of the people were changed, but that's all true.
Wow. So my next question, of course, is you've worked for decades helping other authors achieve their dream, get their stories out to the world. What intrigued you about writing your own story? Has this been a desire for a long time? Were you just waiting for the story to come up? What was it that brought you to this point?
Do you have a hobby other than this?
Well, this is about it.
Okay, exactly.
Raising kids.
Yeah, well, like I don't do trains, and I don't play tennis, and so on and so forth. And you know, there comes that time where God, I got all these things in my head. How am I ever going to put them all down and not lose them for the next generation? And so I just sit there and type, and it's binging. It's pure hedonism. I sit there, my wife is, God bless her, makes me cups of tea till she falls asleep, and I'm still there at 3 a.m. typing away, and it's just pleasure. It's like a glorified hobby.
Wow. So you say that in your books, these are true events, possibly not factual in the way that you have to unfold them in the story, but they're true events.
Right.
Tell me about the birth of the first book in this trilogy. How did it come out, and what were the events that inspired this?
Well, Murder on Safari is a really simple thing. It pretty much mimics one of my first filming experiences on our program that I did with Bert Van Munster, who now does The Amazing Race. He's my partner on the Wild Things TV shows we did for Paramount, and by the way, which are coming back on CBS apparently, which is nice news. But
nice.
We were going to northern Kenya to film a guy called Simon Thompson who flew his hang glider with vultures in the face of this mountain where the vultures have their nests. And the vultures would attack his hang glider a little bit thinking he was a threat. But then when they realized he wasn't, he would be able to soar with them. And we were getting great footage. Now, go forward 3 years. And friends of mine who live in the Northern Territory of Kenya told us about the Al-Shabaab people who were moving into the area and digging themselves fortresses into the sand. And some of the people that were from that camp came down and then unfortunately blew up the U.S. embassy. So I just combined the stories. Each event is true. And so I was able to set the scene according to what I saw and did. And then I added in the Al-Shabaab part. And what happens in the book is, right in the first few chapters, is all those guys up there doing the filming are witness to Al-Shabaab being in the region, and therefore they become a target of Al-Shabaab. And everything snowballs downhill after that. They're always on the run. They're always trying to escape them. And Al-Shabaab is good at finding them and coming after them again and again. And it's Pero's ability to organize and to structure as a producer does, particularly when you're shooting in the wild, and Mbuno's ability to assess human beings as animals and how they are likely to behave that prevails at the end of the day.
What's fascinating to me are the unique abilities that Mbuno and Pero bring to the story. And, you know, a television producer who's skill at producing becomes a superpower is really fascinating to see, you know, how we all have these unique abilities, and sometimes the you know, least thought about you know, skill set becomes something that that can be crucial when put in this situation.
Yeah, I think that's true, and Pero particularly knows what he doesn't know.
Right.
And he knows how to rely on other people who do know. He doesn't have an ego problem. And the great thing about Mbuno is there isn't an inch of PC about him whatsoever. He lives within the natural world. And if somebody is vermin, they should be taken out. And Mbuno doesn't have qualms about killing somebody who is vermin and throwing him to the crocodiles. No problem at all. Now, you and I would definitely think twice about that. But for Mbuno, he recognizes the animalistic qualities in people and assesses them appropriately. And that's why they make a good team, because Pero knows what he doesn't know and is able to identify people who do know, and he can rely on them and pull them into the situation. Pero's job is really to organize, produce a team effort to be successful. That's really what he's good at. In fact, in the book, one of the characters says to him, you know, Pero, do what you do best, produce us, make this work. And that's really his job. And Mbuno's job is to see the truth, to see with honor what is right and what is wrong and act accordingly. Of course, Mbuno also has incredible skills with animals, and Mbuno, in real life, actually, Mbuno was a, when there was a Mau Mau revolution in Kenya, and the Mau Mau were terrorists in the pure sense of the word. They were terrorizing the countryside in order to try and bring down the British government. And Mbuno, who was never a great fan of the Kikuyu Mau Mau, his tribe and their tribe had been at war for thousands of years. He was enlisted to help the British authorities stop some of the Mau Mau raiders. And Mbuno's method of stopping a Mau Mau raider after they had butchered a woman and three children was to track them down and leave them in the dust, not bring them to justice. That was pointless to him. And he did that many times in real life. And in fact, there's a fellow who was a white hunter turned safari purveyor in Kenya, who was his contact during the Mau Mau revolution, who said there was nobody like Mbuno. You'd send him after five guys who were Mau Mau, and you'd never hear the five guys again.
Wow. Most of us, our familiarity with Africa and the regions in the book, most of us, our familiarity stops with what we see on the evening news, and it's normally not good. What are some things about Africa that might surprise people who have not been there and have not experienced the people and the culture? This is such a fascinating place. What is something that people might not be aware of about the place?
There is no question that everybody I know who has gone to Kenya, East Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, who has gone there, hasn't changed their life. The expanse, the connection with nature, somewhere in the back of your brain is a little primordial memory that you don't really know you have, but your brain recognizes where you are, and you either feel totally at home or you feel totally frightened. There's a very famous story of a film being made called Out of Africa, and the director hadn't actually been to Africa when he started the filming, and everybody had shown up, and he got off the plane and wanted to get back on the plane. The smell of Africa somehow triggered the back of his brain of fear, and he didn't want to shake hands with anybody, didn't want to talk to anybody. In fact, he holed up at the Norfolk Hotel, and they used to have to fly his food in from Paris. It's a hard time for him, and it wasn't phony. It's like claustrophobia. You can't control it. But most people who go to Africa just come away feeling absolutely exhilarated and rejuvenated because they realize that there is the perfect example of primordial life, the way it was and the way it could be and stay. Hopefully it would stay. That's why, you know, the poaching situation is so serious. It's not because the odd elephant gets killed. In America, the odd cow gets killed in order to make hamburger meat. The problem in Africa is that they are wiping out herds because ivory is $2,000 a pound. And even if you kill all the babies who have small tusks, that's a lot of money for the bad people. And the trade in all of that is deadly, and it's terrible. And so Mbuno, being a traditional African elephant hunter, is totally against poachers 100%, was in real life and is in my books.
Wow. The story is absolutely fascinating. It's like getting to go on safari from, you know, the comfort of your reading chair. So far, we've got three adventures with these guys: Murder on Safari, then the Berlin Package. The new book is called Kidnapped on Safari. Will we see more from these guys?
Yeah, currently I'm about two-thirds of the way through the next book, which is Mbuno and Pero decide that after the difficulties of Kidnapped on Safari, they want to reconnect with the beauty of Africa, so they decide to go on a foot safari following elephants migrating into Ethiopia. And unfortunately, things go wrong, and it snowballs from there.
Wow. The new book is called Kidnapped on Safari. It's available everywhere in hardcover and Kindle edition. Peter, I love this book so much. It's a thriller with a completely different tapestry than I've ever read before. If people are just learning about you and want to, you know, dig into your back catalog and follow along with news, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah, at peterriva.com and Facebook. I love comments. I love people writing in and saying things that occurs to them. I'm a good respondent.
Excellent. We're going to put links to all the books and to the website and Facebook in the show notes of this episode. Peter, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Hank, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for doing what you do. I think it's a great service to the publishing world.
Thank you. Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity's only hope of survival entered the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come, then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course, wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class,
he thought. Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right, .doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked. You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?
He asked the mysterious caller. You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you?
He asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.